This podcast is part of the Self Defense Radio Network.
Hey, this is Paul Lathrop from the Polite Society Podcast. You know, a long time ago, I was looking for a tactical mall ninja podcast, and I fell upon this one, and I like this much better. You're listening to Bob Main and the Handgun World Podcast, a practical show for a practical guy like me.
Hi, folks. I'm Bob Main. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Welcome to another episode of the Handgun World Podcast, episode 427. This episode, I am going to be joined by a couple of special guests again. Just like the midweek episode, I've got Paul Carlson and Ben Branham coming up. Hey, and I did put out an episode Thursday morning. I rarely put out middle of the week shows, but I did this time because there's a lot to say. So check it out if you haven't already. That's episode 426, and that was released last Thursday. So this week on this episode, you know, when I was up in Ohio and we put on a great training class with Paul Carlson of the Safety Solutions Academy and Ben Branham of Modern Self-Protection and myself, it was a terrific event. We got together after the first day, I believe, and we talked about two things, visualization and some of the difficulties that gun manufacturers go through that you as a firearms owner and consumer may or may not know about in the gun manufacturing world. So I think you're going to enjoy this. First of all, the visualization part is a terrific way to practice and train when you're out there shooting. It'll help you get a whole lot more out of your practice and your training, and just make you a better shooter overall and make you a better able to defend yourself. And that's really why we do all this, right? And then we talk about gun manufacturing. Paul Carlson's got a little bit of experience with that, not actually making guns, but making gun parts. I've spent many, many years working for a manufacturer, not a firearms manufacturer, but there are a lot of similarities in manufacturing, whether it's guns, whether it's electronics, whatever. And of course, I've been working for an electronics manufacturer for a long time. So just a quick announcement before I get on with the interview. On November 4th and 5th, Paul Carlson is coming to San Antonio. To all of my Texas-based listeners, you want to make this class. And even if you want to travel down here to Texas in early November, the weather is usually excellent down here in San Antonio. November the 4th and 5th, Saturday and Sunday, Ben Branham and I are bringing Paul Carlson into town to teach critical defensive handgun. And you should check that class out. There is a link on my website so you can check out that class. Hopefully get signed up. Remember also that this podcast is sponsored by Concealment Solutions, makers of terrific concealed carry holsters. Jason Christensen will also customize a holster for you if you want. He's real good about that. His turnaround time is excellent. I've seen a lot of long turnaround times in the holster making business, and not so with Concealment Solutions. That's one thing I like about them. So remember to use the coupon code HandgunWorld to get 10% off of your order at ConcealmentSolutions.com. That'll also be in the show notes. Well, here comes Ben Branham and Paul Carlson and yours truly for what I think is a very, very informative interview. Enjoy. All right. Well, for the main topic in the interview section of this episode, I'm sitting with two great friends, Paul Carlson with the Safety Solutions Academy. Welcome to the show again, Paul.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
I'm doing all right.
All right.
And of course, the man who needs no introduction, but I'll say it anyway, Mr. Ben Branham, Modern Self-Protection. What's up, Ben?
The man who needs no introduction.
Yeah. All right, so
thanks for having me on the show, Bob.
Well, you're welcome, Ben, as always. Thanks for being on. So I'm at a level with all the listeners. We are on Paul Carlson's back porch at his house in Ohio. We got whiskey. We got cigars. What do you got there, Paul?
I am drinking club soda, vodka, and lime.
Club soda, vodka, and lime.
Club soda, vodka, and lime.
And I got Canadian Club and Sprite. And Ben's over there. You got what, Straight Crown?
Straight Crown. That's the way to be.
And a big old fat stogie.
Yep.
Yeah, which as soon as we get done here, I think I'm going to partake as well.
Very nice.
I have a PDR cigar, and it's one of their small batch reserves.
All right.
And it tastes good. It
smells good.
I got a good burn going.
Yeah, you do.
So the reason we're here, we just got done teaching day one Beyond Concealed Carry Enhanced with special guest instructor Paul Carlson, who did most of the teaching today and good stuff. And, you know, that's the topic that I want to talk about for this episode. Paul, you did a really good stuff that actually I had not been exposed to before on visualization when you're shooting.
Cool.
And yeah, I was really, really impressed. I wanted to see if I could get you to talk about that again. Maybe sure. Do a little bit of a review of what you taught today.
Yeah, absolutely.
And maybe get into it. But you know, you talked a lot about what we should visualize when we might, if that unfortunate day comes, get attacked. And I've had listeners ask me about this.
Right.
So that's why I wanted to take advantage of this. So give us a little bit of an overview of what you mean when it comes to visualization.
Sure, yeah.
In the shooting world.
Yeah. I think that visualization is an important tool, and it really is a training tool that can help us to expand what it is that we're doing on the square range. I think that, you know, all three of us sitting here will realize, agree, and understand the idea that, you know, live fire on a square range has limitations. It really does. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing it. We should be training with live fire on the range, but we do need to understand what those limitations are. And so visualization is a tool that I teach my students to use to try and increase the accuracy of their training, maybe increase the level of realism of what it is that we're doing on the square range.
How do you do that?
Okay, that's a good question. It comes down to first starting to understand what threats are, right? So we talk about the fact, and I introduced to the students the idea that although they're standing in front of a paper target, or maybe some parts of today we were standing in front of steel targets using steel, we can't look at those as paper targets. And I don't even care if maybe you're using a photorealistic target, right? We still have to do visualization because we're not fighting against paper. If we find ourselves in a violent encounter, it's not likely to be a stack of B-27 targets that are attacking us, right?
Probably not.
And if they do, it's probably not a lethal threat, so we're probably not justified in drawing a handgun and shooting, right?
Right.
Lighter works.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. A lighter works just fine. Maybe a stapler.
That's right. That's a good point, Ben.
So when we find ourselves on the range training, we've got to make it more realistic. We've got to take and bring into it the elements that could be part of a violent encounter. Using realistic targets brings in one of the elements, but then it makes it the same every time. Every time you look at that target, it's the same threat. Instead, how about we think about the fact that the piece of paper is a lethal threat? For most able-bodied males, that's probably another human being with some kind of a weapon that they're capable of deploying against you at a reasonable distance right now,
right,
that can inflict, you know, great bodily harm or death. That's what's going to justify us to use lethal force, right? Okay, so we start there with a person with a weapon. That person probably has height. They probably have weight. They probably have hair color, skin color, clothing. And they might even have words that are going to lead you to understand what their intent is with whatever it is they're holding in their hand. And those are the things that I start asking students to visualize, is the fact that you're not shooting at a paper target. You're shooting at a threat. Now, sometimes students come to class, and you guys as instructors have probably experienced this. Students come to class because something has happened. There's been an acute thing in their life. Maybe there's been an attack they've been subject to, or maybe they face a threat in their life, a stalker, an ex-boyfriend, you know, someone that they have in the past, in the person's mind, caused harm to by, you know, testifying against them in court, right? And then this person now is going to be freed. You know, that's a realistic threat. That's very easy for that person to visualize, right? And sometimes they can visualize one thing too much and they can perseverate on that one threat. Visualization helps us to be able to spread that apart.
That's a good point.
Change the height, change the weight, change the skin color, change the tool, change the stimulus that is encouraging you to realize that you've crossed that line and it's time to use lethal force. That's the key with visualization is we control it in our mind.
And it's a great way to take these still paper targets and make them mean something more than just a piece of paper and cardboard.
Yeah.
They mean a threat.
A threat.
Yeah, what's your take on that, Ben?
I like that a little bit, and I don't mind that at all. I'd like to see you expand it a little bit and remind the students, like every time, change the skin color, change the height, change the sex, change everything about this person.
Sure.
Flip them, whatever you see right now, flip it to what you think is the complete opposite of that person. So it's a fat 300-pound white guy like me. Turn it into a skinny female crack addict that's got a gun that wants money for her next fix.
Yeah.
Just flip it all the way so we don't get that stuck in, you know, and it, not racism, but you get stuck in one look, and for better, worse, right now it's a terrorist. Middle Eastern, 35-year-old male with the normal regalia on his head and everything. And if you always think that that's what's going to be your bad guy, when you get the female crack addict that's 105 pounds sucking wet and looks like a bag of bones, and she's got a gun, you're kind of like, huh, I didn't think that was what that was supposed to look like.
Sure, right.
But other than that, I really like the concept, and I've actually had people asking me about it. They didn't have a real good way to put it. So I'll probably,
me too.
Like most good instructors, I will steal some of your curriculum and start using it.
Keep in mind, you got it.
Yeah, keep in mind, it's not necessarily even my curriculum. You know, there are lots of folks out there that are doing this, and I think that it's important to note that this is something that's being used in all different kinds of facets of life, whether it's training. You know, Bob, you study sales and business.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that there may be some people that are teaching sales and business and teaching visualization along with
that. Oh, yeah. You know, now, visualization is not a new concept to me.
No, not at all.
But it is in the shooting
world. Right, right. Well, and that's one of the things that I love about this industry. And one of the things that I'm trying to do is not create new things, not to invent something new, but look at what it is that's working someplace else and figure out how it is that that thing applies to shooting.
Yeah.
You know, I remember, you know, we've talked several times about this weekend in our conversations. You know, I'm a guy that that originally had passion for the mountains, not necessarily for guns, right?
Yeah.
I remember watching downhill skiing as a kid, and I can picture Pirmin Zubergen, you know, this great Swiss, I think he was Swiss, ski racer, and he would be in a crouch, and he'd be waiting for the start line. He's not racing right now. But it looked like he was. He's in his crouch, and he's got his poles, and you can see him go down around the turn and then come up and unweight his body. And he's doing this amazing dance, if you want to call it that. And what he's done is he's memorized the race course, right?
Yeah, he played it out in his mind.
And now he's playing out every little bit of it as he's getting ready to go there. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that when you go through that visualization, you're firing the same parts of the brain that are fired when you're actually doing it.
And you did a good job of proving that on the shooting range today. And that's what I had never seen.
Tell me how I did that, because I'm not sure I know what you mean right now. Maybe it was
I could see it in the students.
Okay.
I could see their intensity level arise a little bit.
Yeah.
Because the first part of the day,
they shot a little faster, a little more aggressive.
They shot more fast, faster, excuse me, and a little bit, they got more intense, more aggressive. They seemed to get into it more. You know, they seemed to, it all of a sudden meant something to them.
That's
as soon as you asked them to and
that's
visualize.
That's what we want it to do, is we want this to mean something. And one of the things we know about the human brain and learning is if there's an emotional connection to what it is that you're learning about, you learn it much better, right?
Ooh.
So if we can take and we can use visualization to create a deeper connection with the student, then we're going to get better learning. Now, we have to be careful, because if it actually turns to fear, right, if the student is actually in fear because their visualization is so good, they may not be learning at all. The brain doesn't learn well when it's in a state of fear, a state of great stress. So it's an interesting thing, and it's a balance that has to be walked to get there to be enough realism that it's like they're there, but they don't feel like they actually really are.
And I'm glad you just brought that up, because tomorrow we're going to have them do a shoot the hostage taker drill.
Right, okay.
And we're going to bring them right to the brink of fear.
Right.
Bob messes with them emotionally.
I do mess with them. I'm sorry to admit that, but it's true. But it's necessary, because you're going to see their intensity level double tomorrow.
Well, and we have to at times manipulate the situation that our students are in,
right,
so that they experience realistic things that they might experience in a violent
encounter.
We're
going to do that tomorrow.
And you guys saw that today, and I don't really want to say how it is that we did it, but there were times when I had the students stopping and giving a puzzled look when I asked them to do something that was completely reasonable, and they had confusion because they didn't understand it. And then they said, oh, now I get it.
Yeah.
They went from a point of not recognizing what the situation was to then that point of recognition, and that point of recognition then takes them to, oh, this is the action I need to execute.
Yeah.
And that's the goal, is to get people thinking.
Well, you did a good job of it.
And I can tell you from being in a shootout, that's a good thing, because I never could explain it besides you have this, oh my God, moment, this is happening to me.
Right.
And it, so 11 gunfights in 03, every single one of them I had this, holy bad words.
Yeah.
Right. And then I can break that and act. And every time it happens, you break it a little bit, it's a little faster, a little faster. And then in 08 and 09, when I was over there, I had a couple, and it was just, I got over that, and it was into it. My training was better individually and stuff, so I just, it was easier for me to break that holy crud moment. But I really think it's because 11 gunfights, 10 years of training, I'm a little better now. But I think everybody that hasn't been in a gunfight, that isn't super extremely trained and hasn't visualized this a lot, they're going to have this, oh my God, moment. This is happening to me. Now what do I need to do?
Right.
And you just have that freeze kind of panic thing, like, and then better training you have, the more you visualized it, the faster you're going to get through that hiccup moment and be gone. And it could be half a second. It could be a quarter of a second. It'll feel like all day
that
you freeze, because your time distortion goes wonky. But so I think it was really good that, and then you played with the students too. You gave them different commands, not always the same command. Got them thinking on their feet to go, oh no, I'm supposed to act. You know, they had to get to that. They had to think through things to get it too. So I think that'll help them in that oh crap moment.
Right, right.
And to get them moving.
Ben, did you use some of those visualization techniques in combat?
No, because I was, with the Marine Corps, we were so well trained, it was all into rote. It was immediate action drills.
Yeah.
If you got attacked here, here's what we do. If it happens like this, here's what we do. And it gets to the point where you just do it so many times, you walk through it so many times, you talk about it so many times, that bang, 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 get down, crawl online, assault through that way, and we're done. And it came, some of it was right out of the book that we did. It was just like, oh, look at that, you know, the book. And then other stuff was just a cluster, but it was being able to walk through it by rote. But that, the Marine Corps infantry guys, and I'm sorry to say this, and people are going to hate me, I don't care, it's way different than being on the street. Marine Corps infantry, I have a pretty good idea, and we were going to take Iraq. I had a pretty good idea what our battle was going to look like. I had studied my enemy. Our books weren't as good as they are now, but I knew a lot about them. I knew how they fought. I knew how they thought when they fought.
Yeah.
I knew what they were going to try to throw at us. I knew the weapon systems they were using. Mm-hmm. I knew the weapons, everything about them. I knew all this stuff. I knew their tactics almost as well as I knew my own. And so we had just started training that for months. And it was just all by rote. If we get attacked this way, here's what we're going to do. If we get attacked while we're on the march doing this, this is what we're going to do. If we're carrying this gear, here's what we're going to do. If we're going to, I was in a small unit. Part of our small unit tactic was speed and camouflage.
Right.
We just did not have the fight. There's 15 of us. We don't have the fight to put down 100 guys. We just don't carry enough ammo, enough weapons. And our job as a mortar squad was to support the main objective. So we just had to hold enough security on ourselves so we could fire rounds out there and be away from the battle. But when you're 3 clicks from the battle or 2 clicks from the battle, which is a mile or two, you're on your own.
Right.
And so we had all of those immediate action drills. If we get attacked and overrun, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
This is where we're going to go. And when we moved into a position, all we had to say is, there's our exfil route. We're all going this way, and we're going out in this marching order. And then we had done it so many times. So on that, it was great. So it was totally different than being, I'm on the street walking around, and I've had a couple things where I have the kid. I got my kid in the basket, and this guy is coming up to me. I know he's evil, but at what time does the attack start, and what time can I use force against him? And I'm always going to use verbals to try to get out of the fight. And that time I was able to get out of the fight, but he totally caught me, like, pants down. I had the kid in my basket.
And we all face that every day. There are times we're vulnerable. End of story. I don't care how alert you are.
Yeah, and I try to be super alert, but my thing was, I'm in a Walmart parking lot. It's downhill. I'm going to have to push the kid down the hill to try to hopefully get him around some vehicles and address this guy that's coming up to him, and I'm going to have to fight him. And I've got no problem with that, except for the kid is going down the hill in the basket, and he was maybe 2 at the time, so he was in the basket. He can't get out, and now he's going down the hill in this parking lot, and he's on his own. And at the time, you know, I flipped through the file folder, and I'm like, what am I going to do if this guy, if this goes sideways and goes lethal? I have to push the kid down the hill, hope for the best, take care of this guy, and then run after the kid. And it just, so those file folders, I mean, who would think about that? I'm going to push my kid in the basket down the hill. I mean, who would have ever thought that before it happened to me? What am I going to do? But just, you know, the experience and stuff taught me to come up with a plan right there, so if something goes sideways, I can execute it. But it's totally different than the Marine Corps, so the visualization you're doing is good, because they just, they get that oh my gosh moment. And then the stuff you did as the rest of your visualization, and you talk about that on the stopping the threat.
Yeah, I like that.
That was almost an epiphany for me. Every once in a while I get something in the firing world and I go,
and it's a huge compliment. Thank you.
It's the head slap moment. But I always think about, I'm going to shoot the target to the ground, and pretty much it's easy. I keep running that front sight, running my link, shooting them until I'm shooting at chest height, and they're no longer there.
Right.
When they fall down out of my line of sight, that's when I know I stopped shooting, because he fell down in a heap.
Right.
But what happens if I shoot him once and he starts screaming, don't shoot me anymore, and puts his hands up?
And turns around and starts running away.
Or just puts his hands up.
Either, yeah, both are options. Around. So let's talk a little bit about that. And Bob, this is your show, obviously, so I don't want to take over, but tell me if you want me to go a different direction. But, you know, the visualization doesn't stop, you know, when we see the threat coming. We also are, I'm going to say, straight up negligent if we don't visualize and train for the stopping of the threat. We can spend time on YouTube looking, or Live Leak, looking at instances where people fail to stop using force when they are no longer justified in using force. And that can lead to criminal problems, you know, the loss of your personal freedom, getting locked up in prison. Mm-hmm. It can result in a loss of personal security from a financial standpoint, from a civil suit. When a threat stops, we need to stop using force.
Yeah.
And as trainers, if we don't help our students understand that, then we have a problem. So,
and I thought that was one of the best parts of your training this morning, is getting them to start thinking about that and visualizing it. That,
how
hey, you know, when the threat
end?
Stops, you know, he doesn't have to fall down to stop threatening you.
Right. Yeah.
He could put his hands up, say, okay, or I quit, or he could turn around and start running the other way.
Yeah. Okay, stop shooting me.
Stop shooting.
Running away.
Yeah, I look at it really in three different ways, right? You know, and everybody goes, and Ben, I think you even said, when I said, you know, when do you stop shooting? And you said, when he's piled up on the ground. That was like almost an instant answer for you.
When he falls down.
Absolutely. And with your mindset, that makes sense to me, that's your answer.
A little too much Marine Corps, not enough civilian
operator. No, I don't think that's necessarily the case, because that is a possibility. That is one of the three possible
scenarios. That could happen, but it might not happen.
So that's option number one. Option number two is the individual that's attacking you turns around and decides to flee the scene. They decide that, holy smokes, this is not what I bargained for. This is not what I signed up for. I wanted somebody that was easy to roll, and this person's fighting back. I'm out of here.
And I always tell my students in our class, if you pull the gun and the guy screams, don't shoot me, pisses his pants and runs away, you just had the best gunfight that there ever could have been.
Right?
Yes,
and it might come after one shot. Or no shots. It might come after one shot over the right shoulder. Like, holy crap, dude, this is a guy with a gun that actually intends to use it.
Yeah.
I'm finished. They turn around, run away. The possibility exists, and I don't like this as a real scenario, and I'll tell you why. I don't like the idea, but somebody might simply put up their hands and say, "Hey, man, whoa, I'm out, man. Stop."
Don't shoot me, bro.
So now all of a sudden you've got a situation where you're unfortunately holding somebody at gunpoint. And we were pressed for time today. So, Ben, you talked about the idea of you'd like it if I reminded students to change things. And, you know, over the course of a two-day class, of the critical defensive handgun class, we talk about that a lot. But because we're three instructors coming together today to teach a course,
and we are teaching a lot of stuff, I had to
break it down to the bare minimum. Absolutely that. But the other thing that I think is critically important is I don't like that situation of holding somebody at gunpoint. I alluded to this briefly, but man, if you're holding somebody at gunpoint, are they just waiting for the moment to get the drop on you and take the gun from you?
And
are they keeping your attention while somebody's coming up behind you?
That's a good point.
I don't like that situation, and it gets you into all kinds
of questions. You did give the example. You said, hey, get out of here. I briefly touched on it.
And that's exactly what I did is instead of trying to explain the concept to the students, I literally just demonstrated. I simply started to circle in one direction while talking to the individual saying, hey, man, now's your chance to get out of here. Get out of here. I don't want to have to see you, man. Just go, and I'm going to leave you alone.
I got to call the cops in a couple minutes.
That's what I'd like. But you're asking the person to leave, and that's the most important thing.
I got that from another instructor that I don't know if he wants to be named, so I won't name him on that part.
Bill Williams was his name.
Bill Williams did that?
Yes. That's very well-known instructor.
That's not who I got it from. Okay. But, it was just, and I picked that up. I'm like, you know, I do not want to be holding somebody at gunpoint mm-hmm. at my house for 20 minutes for the cops. And it's not 20 minutes for the cops to get there. They'll be in there in five, but they may not come and take control of that person for the next 20 minutes. Right. And I'm holding them at gunpoint.
Right.
I don't
And you've
care.
Got a gun in your hand when police arrive.
Right.
I don't want that situation either.
I look like the bad guy.
Right.
And I don't want to put my gun down because I'm looking at the bad guy still.
What if the police say, drop your gun? And, well, so visualization, I'll just move on from that. I'll just leave that hanging there. Right?
Okay.
The police say, drop your gun and insert SIG.
Well, yeah, I'll just say mine's a Glock and it's not a P320, so it's not a big deal.
I have dropped.
Oh, we had to go there, didn't we?
I have dropped my Smith & Wesson multiple times, as I did today on the range on purpose, and it didn't fire. But it did go from slide lock to slide home, and it distracted the crap out of me. So that's why you got to train and test your stuff. I never thought I'd drop the gun, and it would go from slide lock to slide forward. I've never had that happen on other guns.
It happens often, actually. I see that when I teach backup gun in secondary gun classes is – I'd say probably 50% of the time you drop your primary on the ground and it goes into battery.
Thinking about how the gun works, that totally makes sense. It's just never happened to me before. And it's funny, I pull my back up and I'm pressing the trigger through that long trigger stroke on the revolver. I see that slide go home and I go, huh, that's interesting. Bang. And I miss by like 4 inches. I'm like, what were you doing? Pay attention, knucklehead. You know, why were you paying attention to your gun on the ground when the bad guy's standing there? So visualization right there. I'm paying attention to the gun on the ground when it's a useless item to me at that point. But, yeah, the visualization was really good.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I did like how you wanted to change it up. Hey, this time, picture the guy putting his hands up or do something else. Whatever you pictured last time for him to stop being a threat, picture something. Picture he ran around you this time. Picture that he went down to the ground in a heap.
Yeah.
Picture that he put his hands up. Picture, you know, so we went over a bunch of those, and there's, you know, there's three or four that – yeah, he turns and he runs, he puts his hands up, he drops his weapon, or you're shooting him, and it's not like the movies where you shoot him and he flies back through the wall and drops the gun. Well, you shoot him three or four times and he drops the gun to put his hands over the holes that are spitting blood now. Well, he's still standing there, he hasn't said he's given up, but he dropped the gun, so for all intents and purposes, he has given up.
There's no more lethal threat to you because he doesn't have the tool.
If I continue to run the front sight and just keep plugging him, technically, I'm liable in court. And then not only in court, and this is something I think I have coined as an instructor, problem number two shouldn't be your court battle. Problem number two is that you need to face yourself in the mirror after the event is over. And I can point to law enforcement, military guys, 22 a day are taking their lives, and I think a lot of it has to do with they can't live with what they were told to do over there, and they, like good soldiers, good Marines, they followed their orders, even though they knew that it was bad and unethical and everything, and they came home and they didn't get help and wanted the pain to sell up, and so they eat their gun.
And unfortunately, it happens to a lot of them. That's not talked about enough today either.
Yeah, so I always like to talk about that. That's problem number two. No matter what happens, you got to survive, and then you've got to look yourself in the mirror. And then, so can I look myself in the mirror if I'm running the front sight, I didn't do anything wrong because I'm running the front sight. I'm waiting until that guy goes in a heap. He dropped his gun. He put his hands up, and I've got bullet holes going through his hands and into his heart. And the evidence clearly shows that his gun was not in his hand because there's no bullet damage to the gun, and it went through his hands. Well, what did I, you know, I'm like, dude, I should have stopped shooting.
Well, yeah. We're also getting into the same kind of conversation that you get into when people start talking about, you know, shooting someone in the back. And the simple fact is that sometimes the rounds are coming out faster than you have the ability to stop them coming out when you recognize.
Yeah, that's a good point.
There's a threat. You know, Ben, you talked about today, you gave a specific number, and it's a reasonable number, 0.17 splits, right? With my Glock, quote, 18, quote, that came up at dinner. That was fun.
Yeah.
You know, I run about 0.17 splits on, let's say, a quarter-size Zipsic target, or maybe they're half-size. What are those steel targets we were shooting today?
They were like three-quarters or
half-size. They were probably about three-quarter Ipsic.
Three-quarter Ipsic size.
Yeah. Okay. They were a little bit.
So
like
I'm running 0.17s at 5 to 7 yards with the Glock 18. Okay, understand the typical response time of someone when you make a decision is between 0.21 and 0.3 seconds. You know, so I recognize that someone has turned and is ready and I need to stop shooting. I might fire two more rounds. That doesn't mean that I did something wrong by shooting them, quote, in the back.
You fired them before you could react.
Absolutely. And so the same situation with you, Ben, you know, they drop the gun and, you know, let's say put their hands up, stop shooting me, or they clutch their heart and you put rounds through the hand. That may be an absolutely reasonable thing to have happened simply because of how it is that our body works.
Yeah.
And the amount of time it takes for that signal to get from the brain to the finger to say, time to stop the press to the rear.
I know that intellectually, I'm a math guy, numbers like you.
Yeah.
But when it comes to emotionally, did I do the right thing? Can I shave in the mirror every morning knowing that I did this and it was the right thing to do? And I bring up shooting somebody in the back during going into a big church shooting. They come into the church, they're going for the pastor or their front, just trying to kill as many people as they possibly can. I have no problem shooting them in the back. I would prefer to do it that way because he's not looking at me. There's another great way to have a gunfight. He never saw me and I shot him and he's done. Great. He never shot at me. You know, awesome. But I could live with that. Can I live with that this guy gave up and I continued to shoot him and it was that third or fourth round that was lethal when he gave up at round one or two. And it could be totally justified by the times and everything, and I know that intellectually, but emotionally, can I live with that? So I appreciate you talking about that visualization more so I can be a better gunfighter and more ethical and be around to take care of my wife and my kid.
Well, and the key to it, I think, for everybody is the idea of realizing or recognizing that point when things need to stop. The more we visualize and visualize realistically, the sooner we're going to be able to recognize in a real confrontation that force needs to stop being used. Or on the other side of the coin, that we need to start using force.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah.
Visualization can also help you realize a little bit earlier when you do need to use deadly force.
I brought up Craig Douglas, South NARC.
Yeah.
He does ECQC, which is a great course. I participated. I haven't been able to do both days yet. Just my schedule didn't work out. But I did a Friday night muck, managing unknown contact.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably one of the most important 3 hours of training that people can do, which helps you to understand the visual cues that violent criminal actors are going to use, and I shouldn't say are going to exhibit when they're about to attack you. Understanding and recognizing those cues and visualizing those in your training can then help you to recognize them faster in real life.
Yeah, and then I'm lucky on that part, going through a police academy, wanting to be a cop for a lot of years, taking tons of law enforcement classes, hanging out with cops. It was my thing for 5 years or so. I'm better off now, but
I was going to say you should be a firefighter, dude.
Yeah, no.
Yeah,
tough.
No. Wrong calling, Ben.
Tough to be a cop these days.
Yeah, it's tough, and so it just wasn't for me, and I'm good for that, and I'm thankful that it never happened because I'm a happy person. But I was lucky, and I've got all those cues. Yep. I had very good instructors. Everything from, okay, you think this guy has some training in Taekwondo, Kenpo, or any of the kickboxing sports kind of thing. If he takes off his shoes, you're screwed. I mean, it's a simple thing. Those guys don't fight in shoes. It's part of their deal normally that they go up to the mat and they take off their shoes and they fight barefooted. well, if this is a Kempo guy and he's taking off his shoes, or a kickboxer, he's taking off his shoes, he's going to kick you in the head. You better do something about it before he does, because he's probably going to knock you out.
It can even be more simple than that. It can be a matter of someone taking a look to the right and to the left and showing you that they're looking for avenues of escape, or they're looking for witnesses. It can be the fact that they touch their face and groom their face. Often people do that when they're about to say something deceptive.
When they're about to do something.
Absolutely. Clenching of the fists.
Clenching the fists. I like to go along, talk more of that when we talk about podcasts and stuff. I should write a book, right? But I try to get as much out as I can, is that I believe, and I took it from other people, and that these guys psych themselves up for it. Half of them, it's a rush for them. They love doing the job that they do, victimizing people to make a living. And when they psych themselves up with it, same thing, and I've seen it in the real world with the Marines, as we're going on a raid. We are excited and scared at the same time.
Sure.
And you can see that, and if you look close, and it depends on what your timeline is, you get the adrenaline dump and how well trained you are. Well, these guys, as they do it more, if they've done it 500 times, the guy's not going to get the adrenaline dump, but he's going to be excited.
Right.
The newer guys that might even be more dangerous, they're getting that adrenaline dump. They have it before he even talks to you. He's got the adrenaline dump. He decided, you're my victim. I'm going to go get this guy. And as he's walking up, it takes 3 to 5 seconds to get that adrenaline dump. He gets that dump in his system, so he'll look like he's on drugs.
Right.
Big pupils. He's scratching his face because it itches. He doesn't understand why. He's clenching his fists. He's got nervous energy. He's looking around. He just doesn't know what's going on because he had that adrenaline dump. And when they get better, they learn how to control that. But I always thought that that was a good sign to do that. And I had a... Oh, talk about being caught with your pants down. I used to go to the church in the morning to help set up every morning.
Right.
And because my family was all asleep at 4 o'clock in the morning, I had to be there at 4:30. I would stop at the gas station on the corner and get a donut. And part of my problem right now is that I need to lose weight because I used to get a donut every week going to the church. And I knew the guy behind the counter by name because it was the same guy every Sunday morning. He worked the Saturday night shift, and we used to talk about some crazy people and stuff. And so I go halfway back, and then, you know, come to think of it, I should have never been. I never go in this store because there's no back exit to the store. All the store exits are in the front. So I'm coming halfway down the aisle, and they're at a zigzag to the front, the two front entrances. This guy walks in with something big bulge in his pants. One side, he's holding up his pants so they don't fall down on one side. Big baggy wannabe gangbanger shorts, and he's got that excited, scared look to him. He locks eyes with me. I lock eyes with him. I put my food on the rack, and I'm ready to bolt. And I look over at the counter, and the guy behind the counter, I forget what his name is, we'll call him Mike. He goes, "Hey, sir, can I help you with something?" And he goes, "Yes." And he looks at Mike and walks over there with an excited kind of gait to him. And he's holding his pants up because they're falling down because there's something heavy in there. And I'm like, oh, shit. You know, and at that point, nobody's there. Where's my gun? In the truck. Dummy. You know, it's just 4 in the morning. I hadn't put it on yet. I was just being lazy. So I go up behind the counter and I'm like, well, I can't leave Mike. He's got a family. And I just can't live with myself if I just walked out. So what am I going to do? So I walked up behind him, and this guy, I could see the wheels turning in the back of his head, like from behind. He is trying to decide what to do. Him and I locked eyes. He walked to the counter guy, and the guy's like, Mike's like, "Hey, well, did you want something?" Like, there's this pregnant pause.
Right.
So I went over, invaded his space a little bit, put my stuff on the counter, come up with a quick plan. It's obviously on the right side. He's going to go for it. When he does, I'm going to put my hand on it, I'm going to trap it, and I'm going to stab him in the throat because that's the one weapon I have. I'm not going to let Mike die because some idiot at 4 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning, and I'm just not going to be that guy. So I invaded his personal space on purpose so he would know I was there. So I'm super close to him, put my food on the counter, said, "I'll take that, Mike." And he looked at me, he looked at Mike, he looked at me, he looked at Mike, and I got my hand in my pocket where my knife is, ready to flink, huh, and my other hand up. I'm like, we're gonna go, I'm ready. And he looked at me, he looked at Mike, and he goes, "I'll just have some menthols." He held his. He never moved his right hand, held his pants up the whole time, left hand with the money, took his cigarettes, and left.
Good.
And Mike looks at me.
Good
goes,
ending.
Yeah, Mike looks at me, he goes, "That was weird." I was like, "You have no idea, dude."
But even though it was weird, it was a good ending.
We're just going to call that one done.
And, yeah, you know, call that one.
I was happy to do, but you could see it was that primal fight or flight. Everything was going on, and I could see the wheels in the back of this guy's head. He's thinking, how am I going to jack this guy? And I was hoping he's not thinking, am I going to kill this guy and the other guy too? But he probably was. Do I have to kill them to get away? Yeah. Are the cops going to catch me if I leave them alive? How am I going to do this? And he's thinking the whole time, how am I going to do this? And that excited, scared look.
Yeah.
And I was the adrenaline dump and stuff. I was taught to notice all that. And then when you see it a couple times, you're like, oh, it's like when your kid, and I say, look at your dog. Your dog is the ultimate body language. It will tell you if it did something wrong. You look at your dog and you call it by its name. The dog will tell you if it did something wrong. Right. Your little kids, when they're five or something, did you take a cookie from the cookie jar? No, daddy. And, you know, the body language, it's all the same. They just hide it better. And so it's kind of, you know, your kid gets excited because we're going to Disneyland or something. They're so excited that they can't hide it. And they're jumping up and down and say, let's go, let's go, let's go. So
I've been there, done that.
3 a.m, they're waking you up. Dude, you got to wait till it's light so we get on the road. You know, stuff like that. But it's, to me, it's all the same. That body language, those pre-fight indicators, they all look the same. And it's kind of cool. I'm the ACLDN?
ACLDN, Armed Citizens Legal Defense.
I can never get their acronym, and I can never say their name. When you join them, they sent out a video set, and one of the videos was pre-fight indicators. And the guy did a pretty good job of acting them all out.
Right.
So you got it on video what people look like. You'll never get the true adrenaline dump, the guy's scared and excited at the same time look, but it's pretty close. And you can see some of the adrenaline dump, guys get excited. You ever watch the beginning of a high school or college football game? They're beating on each other in helmets. They're jumping on each other. They're ready to.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, they've got that adrenaline dump. You can look at it when they're jumping up and down so excited that they can't sit still. Got that adrenaline dump. So
All right.
You start looking at that stuff. Pre-fight indicators, like you said, it's an awesome way to go. If you can pick up those and you can get left a bang. But the visualization helps once the fight's on. That visualization is a great way to go. So,
well, really good stuff, guys. Really good stuff on visualization. And
sorry, again, I chased that rabbit over the deck
down
the street.
Yeah, that's all right. It was good stuff, though, Ben. But good. This was excellent to talk about the visualization. And Paul, again, you did a really good job.
Appreciate that, Bob.
Yeah,
thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. My pleasure. Hey, whenever I see something good, I have no problem complimenting it when it's.
We will
it's
totally
good and
use
it's
it
applicable,
and,
yeah.
And mention, hey, I got this from Paul Carlson.
Got it from Paul Carlson Safety Solutions Academy. So let's shift gears, guys. At dinner, when we took a bunch of students out to dinner.
Right, right.
I had a conversation with about a half a dozen of them. We were talking about manufacturing. And the reason we were talking about manufacturing is because one of the students was bringing up questions like, hey, you know, why don't gun manufacturers put certain things on pistols that we all need? For example, he's a lefty.
Right.
And he says, you know, how come we don't have enough gun manufacturers making left-handed friendly this and left-handed friendly that? And, you know, it wouldn't take much to re-engineer some parts to make some changes and things like that. And I wanted to get your inputs on this because I've worked for a manufacturer now for almost 18 years.
Okay.
Not a gun manufacturer, but an electronics manufacturer. But manufacturing in general is a lot the same.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of differences between making guns or making security electronics like my company does, or making cars or making whatever. And I was trying to explain that one of the things that manufacturers look at is after they've engineered something, after they've engineered a gun, and they put it out to market, they look at how much is it going to cost us to make the changes, and what's our return going to be if we make those changes.
Right.
And so I was trying to explain to them, well, you know, certain gun manufacturers might look at that and say, if we were to take this gun and make it more left-handed friendly, well, it might cost us about $800,000 to do that.
Right.
And we're not really sure if we want to spend the $800,000 because are we going to sell $800,000 more worth of these guns?
Right.
Because they're left-handed.
To make it worthwhile for us to put that R&D and all of the things necessary.
Yeah.
Because it's hard. It's hard for a manufacturer to bring a product from the engineering and production all the way to market.
Oh, my goodness.
And you know that. You know a little bit about that.
Paul's
and yours is on a small
right
scale. You're not making guns, you know?
Bob, I'm making a tiny little part with no moving aspects to it. You know, the plan B for the Smith & Wesson M&P Shield.
Yeah.
So let me bring this into real terms for folks.
Yeah, go.
I don't mind, you know, being transparent with this, right? I received at the end of June, actually it was second week in July, actually. I received an estimate on the mold that was going to be made to take the Shield Plan B to polymer, okay? Yeah. And I was actually thrilled with the price. The mold to make a tiny little magazine base pad was going to cost me $7,500.
Wow.
That is actually, I know that sounds like a big number, or maybe you're saying, wow, it was a cheap number, but for a mold, it's actually quite inexpensive to get the actual mold
made. Oh, I actually thought it was expensive.
So,
okay,
I was happy with that price. Now, keep in mind, I spent close to $5,000 on the engineering, so someone working on the drawings to make it right so that the mold could be made. So now we're talking $12,500 right there just to have this mold made.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the next week or so, the next process was called a DFM. I don't know what it stands for. I could probably make up a whole bunch of initials for what
I
it meant to me.
I can think of a few things.
Right? And then we've got one word that's got to be in there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, dang. I think it's dang. Right?
Dang?
Okay, yeah. That was the word.
I thought it was function.
Oh, there you go. Right, exactly.
So yeah, I was going to go Marine on you and say another F-word. Right.
No, please don't do that on my show, Ben.
Yeah, something.
Not on my show.
Not on this show. No. Family friendly. But sometimes you get so frustrated with things, you're like, oh.
So the part and the mold went in for the DFM, and we got back a 27-slide presentation from the person doing the DFM that said, basically, the textures that you have requested, which, of course, I want a heavy texture so it's grippable, right, so that your hand's not going to slide off.
Mm-hmm.
To do these textures, we're going to need to change the way the mold works, and now the mold's going to cost $15,700. So we've more than doubled the cost of the mold because the angles aren't quite right. There's not enough degrees of angle in the base pad from this spot to
this
spot.
See, I'm already lost.
Right? Yeah, so am I, Bob. I don't even, you know. And so here I am. I'm a gun guy, right? I've seen a problem. I want to bring a solution to market. And yet, I don't necessarily know the manufacturing process. And all of a sudden, I'm having to make these choices of, okay, am I going to make the product how I believe it should be, or am I going to make changes? Now, the amazing and wonderful part of this is I went back to my engineer and I said, well, here's the problem. Let's put our heads together. We spent some time on the phone. I started looking at other magazine base pads, and I was able to change the design, make it even better than it ever was, and then get the price back down to that $7,500 range, right? But this manufacturing process, that simple thing of the texture that I wanted doubled the price of my mold.
Yeah.
And so manufacturers are forced with that kind of situation. Well, you talk about the idea of, you know, to make this change for a left-hander, if they're dealing with molding plastic parts and they need to change the mold on the grip of a handgun to make it happen, that mold is not a $7,500 mold. It's not a $15,000 mold. It may very well be a $150,000 mold.
Yeah, exactly.
That's going to take $75,000 in engineering to get it to happen, not to mention the fact that, well, what do we do with all of those models that are already out there that now, if I've got, say, 200,000 units that
people are
going to
want to retrofit those.
I don't want the old one. I want the new one.
Right, exactly.
These kinds of things are incredibly difficult problems for manufacturers.
And you're exactly
to deal
right,
with.
Paul. And mm-hmm. I don't think that's what the average consumer understands.
No.
And so people listening to this podcast right now, I think unless they've actually worked for a manufacturer or in the manufacturing business, you know, I've listened to our VPs talk about the total cost. And you know how these executives look. They look at it as total cost.
Right.
And they have to.
Right.
And then beyond total cost, they look at, okay, what's the return on our investment going to be if we invest this total cost?
Right.
Are we going to, and they're not looking, they're not saying, okay, if we invest $150,000, can we sell another $150,000? They want to sell another $500,000.
Absolutely. It's got to be exponential.
And it's not only that, if it's $800,000 to go to market.
Exactly.
They need to come up with $800,000 to pay all these people.
Right.
And so how long is it going to take to just get to even?
Exactly.
They're always looking at, what's the time to, what's our break-even point?
Right. But then they want even more than
months,
that.
Days, years. Yeah, but it's got to be a profit. Big thing.
It's got to be a profit.
The shareholders, if they're a public company, are not going to be happy with break-even.
No, but no, it's the time to break-even.
They're not even going to be happy
no,
with
no,
that.
No, the time to break-even, how many months
exactly
after we put $800,000 in this at our normal sales cycle right now, or how much more we're going to sell of this product that we just engineered until we recoup our original cost of $800,000.
Right.
You know, if it's 2 months, you're like, okay, let's do it.
But even
but
still,
if it's
even
three
if they can,
years.
But the way my company thinks, even if they can make their return in 2 weeks, that's not good enough for them.
It's still a decision.
They want to triple, quadruple, maybe even 10 times their amount of sales.
Yeah.
And then, that's what they're looking at.
And then absolutely. Public companies, people don't understand, America has a big problem with this.
Yeah.
And they see quarterly cycles. Quarterly earnings reports for...
Got to keep the shareholders happy.
Shareholders. Yep. That's right. All they care about. So in that $800,000, they got to bring that product to market, spend the $800,000, and in 1 quarter, they need to recoup their investment so that the stock price doesn't change.
Yeah.
If they're $1 million in the hole on this investment, and that means their company has $1 million less liquidity, it has $1 million less value, and that could affect your stock price
exactly.
a lot. Or you
back to the shareholders again.
You show, you know, oh, we did $1 million worth of R&D, so we have a $500,000 loss, or, you know, the numbers are arbitrary, it doesn't matter. This quarter, we have a $500,000 loss. You know what happens to that CEO? You're fired.
He's gone.
Right.
So, yeah, this stuff is not easy. And
no, it's
the
not. And I wanted to bring it up because I see on the internet, of course, where everything is true, right?
Sure,
on the internet,
absolutely.
And
well, Abe Lincoln posted it.
He said that everything on the internet is true.
Right.
So
yeah,
I
you know,
him.
Abe Lincoln, he invented the internet before Al Gore did.
Absolutely,
didn't
he did.
I thought he did. Okay.
Yeah. I still like the meme that he says everything on the internet has to be true.
To be true. But anyway, I see so many people saying things like, well, why can't Ruger just do this? Or why can't Glock? Or why can't Smith & Wesson? Or how come, you know, Springfield couldn't just make this little change? It's not a little change.
No, it's not.
Most of the time, it's not.
Right.
We as consumers, or, you know, we perceive it as a little change,
and
but it's not.
It can be huge.
It can be huge.
And I absolutely love engineering and stuff. If I had to redo my life again and they said, you can't be a Marine, you can't do firearms instructor and stuff, I would be an engineer.
Like Boilermaker Steve?
Yeah, I would be a mechanical engineer.
It's one of our students this weekend.
Purdue's a good engineering school.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't it?
But I would be a mechanical engineer, and guns or parts like that would be my thing.
Yeah.
So just to engineer the part, let's say an ambidextrous magazine release. Smith & Wesson has one, Glock does not. That is an amazing marvel of engineering. Pull it out of your Smith & Wesson, look at it. It's not just a flat piece of steel. It can't go straight across to being reinforced. It can't bend because of the forces involved to let the slide go home. And I'm going to throw your favorite company under the bus here, Remington. They came out with that
Remington? I don't even know them.
Yeah. They came out with the R9.
Make good
ambidextrous slide release. Well, that part internally would flex, so it would work as a slide stop on the left-hand side for a lefty, but it wouldn't work as a slide go home. When you push that down, it doesn't matter how hard you push, because you would push it and you could feel the metal flex.
Right.
And it's really the stop is on the right-hander's side. So if that metal flexes, that part doesn't work. So Remington screwed that up. They got to re-engineer it. It's an easy fix, but they didn't ask me, so I'm not giving them free stuff. You can pay me for that fix. But, we played with a bunch of them, and I had to push with both thumbs hard enough to make an indention in the plastic to get the slide to go home with the slide stop on where a left-hander would use it. So it's not just a simple, all you got to do is put it on both sides. It's an incredible amount of engineering force.
Yeah.
And then they're trying to use sheet metal, a cheap part. Sheet metal, stamped sheet metal is probably the cheapest way you could go in the firearms industry to make
stuff.
Cheaper
than milled, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, oh yeah, and even injected molded, it's cheaper than that.
Yeah.
But what's sheet metal do? It bends. You know, how big a piece of sheet metal do you need so it doesn't bend? It can't bend, so what do? It's all about engineering forces, and if you look at the M&P one, it's got all these little bumps and curves, and it doesn't connect, but it's like got these weird things in there, and at first you look at it and you go, why would they do all that work? It's because that's how it gets its rigidity and its strength, so it works on both sides. So it's kind of it's a cool thing, and there's numbers and computers to help you with all that, and I'm sure somebody that's smarter than me, and I'd love to get into it one time, is the force numbers and all that stuff and the spring tension and all the pounds of pressure and everything it takes. But I'm a way geek on that. But just that little part, that's how much engineering is on that little part.
Yeah.
And that is that part? It's a little lever with a spring on it to keep it down.
Right.
I mean, the spring pushes it down. That's it.
Which is more complex than the product I'm trying to bring to market.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
a lot.
You know, so,
oh, yeah,
so you take the numbers that I brought up and you start to multiply those out and it gets scary.
Because I think, it has to exude force. Your base plate doesn't have to exude force besides not break when it hits the ground.
Well, and here's something else that the people need to realize about manufacturers. And I know this from experience, that whenever a manufacturer has to invest even one more dollar in a product, they need to gain $40 to $50 in profit.
Right.
Because it's not just manufacturing the part. It's hiring the people. It's hiring the engineers.
It's the
HR
time.
Costs of employing the people.
Right.
It's the insurance costs. It's the liability costs. It's all the travel costs. It's this and that. When you start to add all this stuff up, and you brought up a good point earlier, Paul. The last thing that a manufacturer wants to do, and I know the company I work for, my company preaches this all the time.
Right.
The last thing that a manufacturer wants to do is to come out with a new product or a new version that ends up cannibalizing the sales of the older product.
Yeah.
They don't want to do that. So if...
What do you think? Glock Gen 3s are still on the market.
Yeah, and I'm really surprised that Smith & Wesson actually has come out with the 2.0 because it could cannibalize all the rest of the M&P sales.
Which is why we're seeing all the rebates.
I really think.
You know, I don't have any inside information, but my gut reaction is there's a Shield 2.0 coming.
Well, it has to
My
be.
Gut reaction is there's a Compact 2.0
coming.
There's
no other reason why they were given those healthy rebates.
Absolutely.
On the Shield.
They've got to liquidate what it is they have
but
in
stock. But
even
not just for the short future, but the long future. You don't want your new product to put your older product into extinction.
Yep.
Well, you don't want that as a manufacturer.
Yeah. And then the other problem in the firearms world is they always work through a distributor. So, yeah, Smith & Wesson sold 2 million units, I'm making up numbers, 500,000 M&P Shields. Where did those go from Smith & Wesson? They went to the distributor. From the distributor, they go out to the actual gun shops. And from the gun shops, that's where they get in the hands of the people.
Everybody's got to make their piece.
So,
has their fingers in the pie.
Yeah. But not just the piece. That's a long sales cycle.
Oh, yeah.
So Smith & Wesson just doesn't sell out of them and then start making the 2.0.
That's a good point.
Because there's still 500,000 units in the pipeline.
That's a good point.
And you will piss if you come up with a new one and they're sitting on 500,000 units and you come up with the new 2.0 and the distributor has 500,000 units, you just pissed off your distributor, who is your biggest customer.
Right.
I want to go back and ask you a question. They ship guns in pipes? 500,000 guns in the pipeline? That's amazing.
Of course.
Where is that pipeline? I want to get access
to that
thing.
I got to tap into it.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
Well, you know, the other thing that we have to think about, Ben,
it's like
and
guns
Ben just
that are
kinda,
on the street. You just got to find them.
Right.
Ben just touched on this. Ben just touched on this, too, a little bit, is that a manufacturer never wants to... Okay, let me back up. When they release a product, this is the way we do it, we look at the life cycle of that we think that product is going to have.
Right, right.
Let's say it's 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they want that product to stay on the market and make money for 10 years. So if they come out with something else that shortens the life of that first version from 10 years down to 6 years, now they got a problem.
Right.
They got 4 years of profit that aren't there on the
other
side.
And they got a pipeline.
And then they've got
manufactured for a 10-year life cycle. And so now they may have these hundreds of thousands of products out there, guns, let's say guns. They got these hundreds of thousands of guns out there that they manufactured for the 10-year life cycle. But, oh, no, sales have now dropped off after 6 years. What are they going to do with the pipeline?
Right.
With the rest of the 4 years' worth of product that they've already hired the people, they got the machinery, they got things. Some of it's already shipped to the distributors, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Or even worse, that they plan on... That's going to have a 10-year life cycle, and we're going to make X amount of profit for the 10 years of it.
Right.
We cut that cycle short for 4 years.
Right.
We still need to make that profit that piece was supposed to make for those 4 years. And, yeah, it drops off price cycles and all that stuff, but, man, there's smart people that all they do is study that stuff.
Yeah,
your company employs probably a department that just figures that stuff out.
Of course they did. And the other major point I was making to the students at dinner tonight is that, and I think a couple of them were surprised by it, but you, the three of us sitting at this table, we know this. The people who make, who engineer and manufacture guns are usually not gun people.
Such a critical point,
they're not
Bob.
Shooters.
Oh, that's a great point.
They're not shooters. They're not gun people. They don't know. And for the life of me, I can't figure out why don't they find 6 world champion shooters, fly them in, sit them in a conference room for 2 days, buy them beer, cigars, and steak dinners, ask them what they want, and build those products. I don't understand why they don't do that. But the fact of the matter is, most of these people are manufacturing business people. They're not shooters. Yeah. They don't know what a shooter wants. They don't know what a self-defense expert
and
wants.
Even, right, so Paul? I've been waiting for the time to bring up that point, Bob, because that's, I think, one of the most
that's
critical points.
Point.
In automobile manufacturing, everybody that's involved in manufacturing automobiles got to work that day in an automobile.
In a car, yeah.
Everyone that manufactures refrigerators got up and opened up the refrigerator and got out their orange juice or their cream for their coffee or their eggs from a refrigerator. You know, so in so many of the manufacturing parts of America, people have, I don't want to say intimate familiarity, but it's part of what they're building is part of their life in some way. Yet when it comes to firearms, very often the case is the people that use firearms are not necessarily the people that manufacture them. So
that's right.
I'll give you a specific example.
And not only, well, can I bring up one thing for you to example?
Of course you
it's,
can.
You see the CEOs out of these big companies, and they're big game hunters, they're long-distance precision shooters. The guy, the CEO of Ruger right now, he's a big game hunter, and he uses Ruger rifles exclusively, of course, because it's his product. But he doesn't have an intimate understanding of what a defensive pistol should be or what a competition IDPA or USPSA pistol is.
Right.
No freaking clue.
Right.
And not that it's bad. It's just his life is the hunting side of it.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of guys that are gun people that way, and they're just very, very deep into it. Like, right, I'm very, very deep into the handgun self-defense stuff. I dabble in IDPA and USPSA, and I understand the games. But I'm not – you don't want me designing – a USPSA gun, because I'm going to screw it up. There's no way.
I
got to
show you guys that tonight, too.
Oh, yeah, you got the USPSA gun.
Maybe tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Before we have drinks tomorrow night, I'll show you.
That's probably a good idea.
On that point, you know, I was at a writer's event earlier this year, and I wrote an article about this in Combat Handguns. The manufacturer that invited us to this launch of a new product invited their manufacturing manager and other staff members to the event to train along with the writers.
Mm-hmm.
This company's recognizing the fact that there are sometimes that people are out of touch and they don't understand. And their biggest point was, this guy understands manufacturing. This guy understands guns. When gun guy talks to manufacturing guy doesn't even understand the language of gun guy.
No.
When manufacturing guy talks back to gun guy.
He doesn't understand that either.
And this is exactly the struggle that I have.
Yeah.
My engineer has bent over backwards for me, and he should probably punch me in the face for being such a quote, idiot, because I just don't get manufacturing.
He probably wants to punch you in the face.
But that's
probably
not your job to get manufacturing.
No, it's not. But he also doesn't get what it is that I'm talking about with guns.
But see, that
disconnect, we've got to bridge that.
That disconnect can be easily bridged.
It has to be.
Well, it takes leadership.
It does. That's exactly right.
And time and effort.
It takes leadership, time, and effort. You're right, Ben. But it takes the CEOs, it takes the people in charge of these gun companies to have a little bit of leadership and say, you know what? Engineering guy, manufacturing guy, sales guy, and customer service guy, we want you all in a room. And we're gonna figure this out, and we're gonna all come to an agreement for however long it takes.
Better yet, we want you all on a range.
We want you on a range.
We want you all in a training course.
Yes, we want you to come to. We want you to come to Ben and Bob's and Paul's Paul Carlson's course for a weekend. And after you come to and listen to the three of them and teach for a weekend, then we'll start making guns.
And what happens is, you know, plan B.
Then you start speaking the same language.
Exactly.
The plan B that I'm developing, it's not some brainchild of mine. I simply watched my students struggle. I saw a problem,
right,
and then I took the time to figure out a solution.
And it's a great solution,
well,
by the way.
Thank you.
I want everybody
that.
Who's listening to know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I got three of them. I got three of them, and as soon as you come out with the polymer, I'm going to
buy
more.
A couple more.
Right.
Yeah, and they're great. They're great.
I have a total of three working magazines for my shield because you gave me two, and I bought the other one.
So since we're almost ready to bring this to a close, tell people where they can get the Shield Plan B, and what is it?
ShieldPlanB.com. What I've done is I've designed a magazine base pad that locks the sleeve of the 8-round base pad to the, or excuse me, let's say that again. I have designed a magazine base pad that locks the sleeve of the 8-round magazine to its base pad so it can't slide up. In addition, we relieved the backside so the magazine drops free, and we also added texture and ridges so that you're going to be able to strip that magazine should you have a malfunction.
And where can somebody find out about it?
ShieldPlanB.com.
ShieldPlanB.com.
You got it.
Yep. And Ben, what were you going
to
say?
Oh, we're waiting for that product to come out, and so I can buy. I've only got three magazines that I can really train with and use for my shield.
I got
and
six.
Before that, I didn't carry the shield because it didn't work for me. My hands are too big. I'm gorilla sized, and the shield is an awesome gun to carry. I couldn't shoot it worth a darn.
Right.
But I put that Plan B in there, and I went, holy snot! I can hang on to this thing, and now I can shoot it because it makes a wedge in my hand, so the gun doesn't slip and move around. And what it really was, it turned on my hand.
Right.
It was like having a rope. Somebody was pulling through a real thin rope, and I just can't hold on to it because my hands are too big. Nobody else has that problem. I know I'm unique because I have these monster hands, but I'm not unique. There's monsters out there. But the Shield is one of the nicest carrying guns I've ever found.
It is.
It's shootable,
gun.
Too.
It's
for a subcompact, shootable. It's the easiest gun to shoot.
For a subcompact single stack, it's a dream to shoot.
Yeah. Every once in a while, a manufacturer just comes up with something and just hits it out of the park.
And they did with Shield.
Yep.
Yeah.
They
and
did.
I think
more than a million sold.
But
more
I think they listened.
Is it real?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I think
probably a year ago they hit a million.
Yeah, it's more than that now.
And so with the rebates, I mean, who knows where they're at now.
But every once in a while, a manufacturer does it right, like that. They come out with that because they listen to the shooters.
Yeah.
Glock, I've never really been a Glock fan. You guys are Glock fanboys. I love you for it.
No, I'm not.
But Gaston finally turned over the U.S. manufacturing and distributing and marketing and the whole thing to somebody else that was a U.S. shooter. And all of a sudden, we got a Glock 42 and a Glock 43.
Right.
Yeah.
For how many years have Glock shooters been screaming, we need a single stack 9mm?
And they were ignored years.
Absolutely.
And, well, Gaston Glock for years. And
well, they're still ignored about the single stack 19.
You know,
a lot of people are asking for that gun still. I don't know why, but they are. You know?
But you can't fault Gaston because he's made billions of dollars. He's a smart guy.
Well, plus the horses.
And he just said, you know,
Michelle Viscusi.
I'm just not going to do it. This is the product we make. If you want it, buy it. If you want somebody else's product, buy it somewhere else. You know, and then Carr came out. I mean, Carr
started it. People don't realize that.
Carr
Arms pretty much started the popularity of the 9mm
single. But Carr was started to fill that
gap. To go after Glock.
That
exactly.
Glock would
and they
fill.
Sold a lot of them. You know, and they're great guns. I have great things to say about most car
pistols. Manufacturers do it right.
Sometimes they do. All right, guys. I don't want this to get too long, but...
ShieldPlanB.com.
ShieldPlanB. And Ben, for people that are relatively new to my show, because I do have new listeners, where can they find out about you?
I go over to ModernSelfProtection.com. I love to do gun reviews and more of the how-to stuff. And I really like to get... I need to get more into it again, is the left-of-bang stuff. So if you go to my old shows... You'll find what we talked about earlier, a bunch of the indicators, pre-flight indicators, so you can keep yourself out of the fight. That's the best way to win. Just don't be there.
And Ben's podcast is the Modern Self-Protection Podcast on iTunes. Paul's podcast is the Safety Solutions Academy podcast on iTunes. And an occasional appearance on Gun Nation.
Woohoo! Every once in a while. Hey, Doc, if you're listening, let's do another show, brother.
We always
students were asking today.
We always got to mention Doc because he gets mad if we don't mention him.
We got to mention Doc and the Gun Nation podcast. I've been listening to it for a long time. It's very good, so check them out. Guys, this was a good discussion.
Fun.
This was really good, and I got a feeling there might be a part two coming.
Love it.
We could keep going for hours.
Right?
Let's just get another drink and another cigar and keep going.
Yeah, now it's time for me to light my cigar, so hit it, Paul.
All right.
See you later. Well, many thanks to Ben and Paul. I think that was a terrific interview. If you got a lot out of that interview, please let me know. Send me an email, handgunworld@gmail.com. Call in a voicemail if you have comments.
If you call in a voicemail, I'll go ahead and I'll send it over to Ben and Paul and perhaps get an answer from them, get an audio recorded answer from them. I'll send it over to them, and they'll probably do that. And then I'll put the results up here on the podcast. So that number is 210-646-1727, 210-646-1727. Please catch me on Facebook. I always start a Facebook post for every podcast episode. Also on Twitter, I'm Handgun World on Twitter, Handgun World Podcast on Facebook, all that good stuff. And say, I wanted to also mention many thanks to all of you who have been joining the Shooters Club lately. There will be another new video within about a week. And this visualization stuff that they talked about, that Paul talked about, for those of you who are Shooters Club members, there's a nice visualization video on that topic and how to apply it to your shooting. It's going to be on the Shooters Club very soon. So if you're a member, you're going to enjoy that. If you're not a member, get signed up. Just check out the Shooters Club page at handgunworld.com. I'm Bob Main. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. And remember, the loudest sound that a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click, or a click when he's expecting a bang. Please remember to give me an iTunes review if that's how you get this podcast. And shoot straight, shoot safe. I'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.